very big welcome to the Minefield Congregation ahead of yet another service. It's wonderful to have your company with us as we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. Do you see what I did there, Scott? Was it good?
Well, you know, I mean, one of the things that I like doing, Waleed, I don't know if you know this, I'm a sucker for outtakes. I love outtakes.
Right.
If there's a show that I really enjoy and I finish the show, one of the first things I'll do is to go through and, you know, when did they get it wrong? One of my favorite shows ever is Ricky Gervais's Extras. And the number of times, I mean, one of the funniest things in his outtakes is the number of times he would deliberately throw things into a particular line of dialogue in order to set one of his, you know, sort of fellow cast members off laughing. I kind of feel that this is what you try to do most weeks. You try at the beginning just to sort of set me a little off my game.
No, not at all. I'm just trying to keep it a little, like, I can't say the same thing every single week.
Oh, right. Okay.
Well, if it helps, these things usually come to me as I'm saying them.
Well, yes,
I'm not at home planning. I haven't got battle plans drawn out to try. How can I make Scott giggle?
Okay.
You know, point one, point two. It's not the way it works.
All that said, you manage most weeks to do it. So, you know, well done. Well done you. So
thank you.
Here we go. What is at stake, Waleed, in the same-sex marriage debate? Now, even as I say that, I feel like I'm filled with fear and trepidation. Are the Minefield boys really going to tackle same-sex marriage? Well,
not really,
because, I mean, one of the things I'm unimpressed on all sorts of levels by the debate, by the way that we've conducted the debate, by the terms of the debate, by the civility and lack of civility of the debate. But I think one of the things that really high-pressure political contestations do is they focus the mind. They bring the different participants in a particularly fractious, incommensurable debate, and they bring them to the point where they have to name what it is it exactly that is at stake. What are we fighting for? What is it that we're trying to pursue? What are the values that are driving this? And it seems to me that over the last few weeks, we've actually seen the terms of this particular debate sharpen in a way that may well be, in some degree, a bit helpful. So, for instance, those who support same-sex marriage would argue, I think, that what is fundamentally at issue here is the equality of persons under the law, and that what needs to be removed are needlessly discriminatory restrictions. They would say, I think, that this is the main game, and anything else that might be thrown in by their opponents is just a way of muddying the waters. For others,
so it's largely a human rights claim, and that is borne out by the way that the Supreme Court in the United States ruled on it.
That
it's so clearly a rights issue that you don't even get a vote on it.
Yes.
That Congress can't override it. Mm. You don't get to vote on rights being the idea.
And I think one of the things we can then say is that this is an expression of a fundamental right, a basic right, something like the basic equality of human persons. For others, however, and I think, you know, let me be as generous as I possibly can be, because I do think the way that those who oppose same-sex marriage are characterized, I don't think it's overly helpful, generally speaking, or in terms of the current debate either. But for those who are opposed to same-sex marriage, and especially those whose understanding of marriage has been shaped by certain rich theological traditions and whose understanding of marriage is enshrined in certain canonical texts such as the Bible or the Catechism or the Book of Common Prayer, it's very hard to separate same-sex marriage from deep questions of religious freedom and freedom of conscience. And so what, for instance, about a minister who feels that he or she cannot in good conscience perform a same-sex wedding? What about a church school or an aged care facility? Should they be allowed to refuse to hire a lawfully wedded same-sex couple? Should they be allowed to refuse to hire a teacher, for instance, who is lawfully wedded in a same-sex marriage? So for some of those opponents in the same-sex marriage debate, the threat that's posed to religious freedom by same-sex marriage is so grave that it constitutes considerable grounds for opposing same-sex marriage as such. And then in the middle of all that, you've got some for whom religious freedom is also a serious consideration. It might even be regarded as a basic, a fundamental right. And yet it's a right that can be honored by means of putting in place certain protections to ensure that those who live and work within a regime within which same-sex marriage is legalized wouldn't have to violate their consciences. And so I'm thinking can hear of people like Frank Brennan, who would be more than happy to see same-sex marriage legalized, and yet they themselves just want to be sure that there are certain protections of religious freedom that are in place.
And could I point out, Scott, that if you believe the polling, that's where most people sit, actually.
Yes. I think that's exactly right.
So I think support for same-sex marriage amongst those who say they are intending to vote in this postal survey that is still yet to clear the hurdle of the High Court, we should say, but that amongst those who intend to vote, something like 60 plus, 67% maybe, intend to vote yes, but a similar number also say that they want to see religious freedom protected.
That's right.
So that actually does seem to reflect the popular middle ground. I think what becomes interesting is when you start to interrogate what those terms are meant to mean. So the list of things you just ran through, of, you know, should a church, for example, be able to do certain things, I reckon you would find a wide range of views where everyone might agree on one aspect of it, but as you went further and further along that list, people might start to drop off and say, well, that's no longer a religious freedom question.
I agree.
And that's, I think, where this starts to get quite intricate and thorny. It's not just, is religious freedom a good idea, but what does it even mean? What should it mean in the context of a secular liberal democracy embarking upon a process of making legislation?
I think that's exactly right. And even as, I'll confess, as I was going through the list, I'm kind of thinking, well, this really could, it seems to me, classify as a matter of conscience. And then something else, you can already feel that you're right along the edges of something that might be addressed in terms of other terms or might be corrected in other ways other than the invocation of religious freedom. Now, what's kind of curious, Waleed, is that this is a debate that's not just being held across Australia in society, but it really is in many respects, quite a limited debate. The tension here between fundamental human equality and this invocation of religious freedom, this is actually a debate that's now really taking place among the ranks of the coalition. Just listen to the way that this week, Federal Attorney General Senator George Brandis, an Assistant Minister for Social Services and Multicultural Affairs, said Sejelia locked horns over comments made by former Prime Minister Tony Abbott.
What I'm not going to do is be tricked by Tony Abbott and others who were trying to turn a debate about one issue, that is, whether same-sex couples should be allowed to marry, into a broader debate about religious freedom, because that's not what this is about.
I respectfully disagree with George Brandis on this issue. If you look around the world, issues of religious freedom have flowed when we've seen a change to the definition of marriage. It does impact on freedom of religion, it does impact on parental rights, and it does impact on freedom of speech.
So that's where we are left. Is religious freedom part of this debate, or is it a distraction? That, I think, is one pertinent question. But then the second question, which you've already raised, Waleed, is, okay, let's just grant that religious freedom does impinge for many good-minded persons of goodwill in this debate. What are the limits, the boundaries, the borders of religious freedom within a liberal modern democracy? Where do you want to take this, Waleed?
Well, the first thing I would say is, I wouldn't frame this as just being a same-sex marriage question. I think that the question of religious freedom is coming up more and more. And it came up last week. Was it last week or the week before? As we started to learn that the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sex Abuse were going to make a recommendation that priests would no longer be protected under the law, have the privilege of the confessional box protected, so that there would be a legal obligation if someone came into the confessional box and confessed to a crime of child abuse. There would be a legal obligation for the priest to pass that on, which is a massively weighty recommendation that I think non-Catholics, even as myself, it took me a little while to get my head around this, that it's a massively weighty recommendation, because what you're effectively asking priests in that case to choose between is the prospect of imprisonment if it's discovered they don't pass that information on, and excommunication, right? And that's not a simple choice.
It's not. But even the way that you framed it then, Waleed, I actually don't think that that is the fundamental issue. The fundamental issue really is a priest has taken an oath. A priest has bound his conscience by means of this oath, and then violating that conscience is a form of grave violence that one does to oneself and one's soul. And that is precisely the form, I think, of violation of religious conscience that really has...
Well, no. See, I think that's not a helpful way to frame it here, because violation of oaths could happen all the time. The thing that... And that's just a violation of conscience, right? I think where it's a violation of religious conscience, it becomes a different thing, because you're talking about otherworldly consequences that are incredibly grave to the person who feels as though they're bearing those consequences, but mean absolutely nothing to the rest of society, particularly the non-believing part of society that we know is growing, right, and is the basis of our lawmaking. And so it seems when you put all these pieces together or you look at these different aspects of the picture, we're in something of a bind here, because religious freedom and focusing on religious freedom as though it is something different from freedom of conscience is, I think, necessary in order to make sense of these things, because the liberal secular democratic state does override freedom of conscience in many cases. There are times where you would just say, that's an unacceptable conscience, so we will override it. And we do that with non-discrimination laws all the time, right? You couldn't stand before a tribunal and argue that I have white supremacist views and that's my conscience and therefore I will racially discriminate. You would simply be laughed out of court. But once it becomes a question of religious conscience, there seems to be a different weight attached to it. Now, that's for historic reasons. And I think what we're witnessing now is that distinction is starting to be eroded in the public consciousness. And so I think what that calls for is a moment where we actually as a society stop and think, is there a meaningful reality to that distinction that needs to be preserved? And can we be too hasty in just doing away with that distinction? And that is, I think, conceptually, even a separate question from how precisely you would give meaning to religious freedom in the context of, say, the legislation of same-sex marriage. Well, I think a lot of the religious freedom arguments are actually overcooked. I think there's less of a religious freedom question in many cases than is being put. But nonetheless, the concept now is being put centre stage as something that we have to fight over, or at least deliberate over, in the context of a liberal democracy. Would you agree with that characterization?
Yes and no. I don't agree with you on the harsh separation between, say, religious freedom and freedom of conscience. I actually think there's far more of a connection between those two than you're granting. And it's interesting to me, for instance, that in the International Covenant for Religious Freedom, that freedom of thought, belief, conscience are so closely connected to one another. What we mean by conscience isn't simply by ideology or by prejudice or something like that. What we mean by conscience, I think, is something that is deeply part of one's self, that is, if you like, an expression of soul, that is an expression of identity. Now, I'm not saying that conscience is self-justifying, but conscience is formed by different things. And just because it might be errant conscience doesn't mean that that conscience isn't, if you like, deeply, deeply held, or over time and through all sorts of different factors, you know, kind of created or generated in a kind of pressure cooker of different influences. But I think what we do need to recognize is that conscience, whether religious or not, is not inviolable in the sense that it can't simply be granted just because it's an invocation of conscience. Conscience does have an obligation, if you like, to expose itself to public justification, to public deliberation, to public criticism, I think. But what I think is important here, whether it's religious conscience or not, that public deliberation is itself done with an eye to accommodation where that accommodation is in any way reasonable and possible within a polity that's governed by such fundamental principles as equal rights, as equal protections, and so forth.
I think there's a lot in your formulation to commend it, except that we are now at the point of debating the scope of these terms, such as reasonable. That's what the debate becomes about. I do also think that you are overlooking to some extent just how soul-forming something like a secular ideology can be. And, you know, for that reason, I think the fact that we do treat different forms of conscience differently, even if only slightly differently, I think does point to that distinction. But you know what? What do I know? We've got a guest that can tell us a lot more about this and knows a lot more than both of us. You're listening to The Minefield. Well, at least more than me, I should say. You are listening to The Minefield. You can do that on the radio, as you may be doing right now, or you can stream it on the radio app, or you can find it wherever it is that you find podcasts. Just search for it. We should be there. And then subscribe if you haven't already. I'm frankly staggered and scandalized that you haven't. Anyway, Scott, We have a guest.
Indeed. Peter Sherlock is Professor and Vice Chancellor of the University of Divinity in Melbourne. He's a bit of a favourite of ours, and it's a great pleasure to finally get him in the studio on this show. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Scott. Hi, Waleed.
So, Peter, help us out here. Let's kind of go to first principles. Do you think that religious freedom, which is now being quite regularly invoked as being a serious consideration in the current debate over same-sex marriage, do you think it belongs to this debate, or do you think that this is at best a distraction?
I think it does belong to the debate, but I think it's been blown way out of proportion. So I work, for example, quite closely with people in the Coptic Church. Now, for the Copts in Egypt, religious freedom is frankly about the capacity to go to your church and do that safely without fear of your life. Mm. For me, that's the fundamental principle of religious freedom. That's what I see back in a place like, say, 17th century England, where the idea in many ways comes from. You shouldn't, your religious belief and practice shouldn't be regulated under fear of death or torture or harm by the state. So that, for me, is the first principle. I don't think that's at risk in this debate.
Well, that raises the question of what religious practice, what religious practice means. Is the conducting of marriage ceremonies part of religious practice? And is refusal to conduct certain religious ceremonies, if we just take that example, which I don't think is going to be an issue, by the way, but if we just take that example, is refusing to conduct a certain religious ceremony on, sorry, a certain wedding ceremony on religious grounds a form of practicing one's religion? And if there are state-imposed sanctions on that, does that mean there is a denial of religious freedom?
Look, that's a great example. The problem is we had that debate in the Westminster system democracy that we've got in the 18th and early 19th century, and we resolved it in 1837 when the British government passed a marriage act that created the concept of civil celebrants and actually allowed religions other than the Church of England to marry people. Before that, in British society, it had to be done by an Anglican minister. So the minute you disconnect that possibility of religious celebrant and allow for civil celebration, yes, it's implicit in a religious marriage ceremony, but there are other options on the table. So, you know, obviously the thing to say in this proposal, there's nothing that forces a minister of religion to conduct a same-sex marriage against their will.
All right, and then extending it to the case of employees who might contract a same-sex marriage and then be working for a religious institution that doesn't accept that, whether it's a school or a hospital or whatever it might be. Are we still within the realms of religious freedom at that point, or are we not anymore?
My personal view, I don't think we are, but you could make an argument around the freedom of religion, but there I think we've trespassed across the basic right for freedom of movement, freedom of thought, into a different space. And I think for religions, it's a very dangerous area. So if we take a basic Christian theological concept, what is it? There are two, I think, that are key. The first is the dignity of each human person, and the second is the concept of free will. So in Christian theological thought, humans are given free will, they're given the power of choice, but that comes with responsibility. So I think once we hit the area of employment, say working in a faith-based school, if we turned the conversation around and started talking about religious responsibility instead of religious freedom, we might find we're coming up with some different answers.
Wow. See, this is very, very, very attractive to me, because I think one of the things that we're noticing here is that simply talking about this in terms of a negotiation of competing rights, say, you know, a fundamental concept like basic human equality, basic human dignity, versus what outside of Australia is often regarded as a fundamental human right, namely the freedom of, say, religion, religious practice, and religious conscience. I think we're feeling the way that these two concepts maybe come up against the limits of one another, and that we need a whole lot of mediating concepts in between as a way of fleshing this out. I just wonder, Peter, for instance, that, I mean, you know, this is going to be very, very surprising perhaps to both of you knowing my criticisms of political liberalism, but I actually think that John Rawls has proven himself amazingly helpful in the negotiation of precisely these kinds of questions because of the emphasis that he puts on the need of people with incommensurable and oftentimes non-overlapping conceptions of the good or of the good life, the importance that they have in exposing their deepest convictions to one another and allowing those convictions to then be scrutinized and to be compared to, in order to find ways on the ground, if you like, in the very rough and tumble of civic discourse, to find ways for those competing conceptions of the good to accommodate one another. I'm just wondering, by framing this in terms of freedom of religion, are we ruling out the very opportunities for clash and for mutual negotiation and for mutual accommodation that can only come when opposing worldviews, if you like, are allowed to rub up against one another?
Look, that's a great question, Scott, but I think, again, we're trespassing on the wrong side of the boundary. So if you thought about religious freedom in terms of protection of rights, some fundamentals, that to me is a different thing from what's the responsible thing to do? What if there are two good versions of the way to run the world, to run society, and we need to make some arbitration or choices between them? That for me is less about a matter of rights and more about responsibilities. So I think that gives us a different space to think through, you know, should the right of a faith-based organisation to teach its values be in competition with basic employment rights in our society? And for me, I think we're in a different space than should someone be prevented from attending a religious ritual or from worshipping their god?
This is I'm not sure the switch to a conceptualisation of obligation changes the conversation very much, actually, because aren't obligations merely the flip side of rights? And if that's true, all right, let's say I'm a church-based employer and you've denied me the ability to say it's a question of my right to religious freedom. I have to frame it as an obligation. So, I'll turn it into an obligation. I have an obligation now to enact the values and the teachings of the church that has created and runs this institution. And that might mean that having employees that are living in violation of the version of the faith that this particular institution is running is unacceptable because it violates my obligation, or I'd be violating my obligation not to be hypocritical about what it is that I'm teaching and enact those values. And so we get to the same result. I just haven't done it via a language of rights. I've done it via a language of obligation.
I hear your point. And for me, the sticking spot in that is actually education. So when you're talking about faith-based school, it is tricky because what's the purpose of the school?
As opposed to hospitals. Or
that's
something.
Right. Whereas hospitals, social services, aged care, there's a different agenda running. And I think pretty quickly the employment right is going to trump.
I'm getting at is how do you make that decision? How do you say the employment right trumps the religious freedom right? I guess what I'm saying is you're right. At the moment, we just have two competing rights that are being asserted and they're not talking to each other. And that is the reason that it's just so heated and we get nowhere with it. But what we need then is a way of articulating discernment, a way of articulating the criteria on which we resolve this question in favour of one or the other right in any given circumstance.
Okay, can I try two examples with
you? Sure.
First one was the example of the seal of the confessional, the Royal Commission.
Yep.
I think the Catholic Church's statement on that was really interesting because they were saying to, you know, the body politic, don't do this, don't pass a law about this, it's going to conflict with our religious beliefs. But ultimately, they also said, if you pass the law, we would probably, in the most case, disobey it and make a choice about civil disobedience. But the point is you're actually in the realm of choice there. The other example in the same-sex marriage area around religious freedom is I think there's a lot of fear going on in this debate. So politicians who say it's a matter of religious freedom, we're afraid of losing that, in many ways to me reflect the views of the LGBTI community who are saying what we're actually talking about here is not whether I personally get married, but my right to stand up in public and say, you know, I'm homosexual, lesbian, gay, bisexual, whatever, and not have an immediate knockback. And for them, that's coming out of a long history of persecution and fear. So for me, part of the difference between freedom and responsibility is on the freedom side is the capacity to articulate something fundamental about who you are and what you believe. And then on the responsibility side, that's about how we negotiate living in a complex society.
Wow. See, I actually don't mind that as a way of framing the topic, but I think that one of the things that this does open up is the extent to which that this is not simply, I think, a straight up and down, should same-sex couples be allowed to marry. But, I mean, already we are impinging upon deeper moral questions here. And I do think, for what it's worth, that even though maybe religious freedom is not should not be as overblown as it currently is, I can't help but feel that there does have to be some robust statement of a possibility for accommodation, just so that this issue isn't used by either side of the debate in order to prosecute, if you like, some kind of larger statement at the expense of one's political opponents.
Yeah, I agree with that point because I feel that right now we're at a moment where the very concept of religious freedom is being eroded as something that should be valued. By many sectors of society. And that's why I think it's so important to clarify. We're out of time for the radio section. Will you hang around, Peter, for the podcast?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. That's Professor Peter Sherlock, Vice-Chancellor at the University of Divinity in Melbourne.
Look, Peter, I really love the way that you were framing this, I think, towards the end. But let's just try to flesh this out a little bit further, because I do think, and I think it's regrettable that many of those who are strong supporters of same-sex marriage feel at various points as if they have to underplay or devalue just how symbolically and morally rich it is, the legislative change that is here being sought. It's not simply the extension of rights, but I think this is something fully in the order of what someone like Charles Taylor would describe as a full-blown form of capital R recognition. This is a way of saying that not just our humanity, but also our lives, our love, are fully regarded as being fully human of the same order as others. And I think that one of the things then that is kind of devaluing the debate on both sides is when this is regarded either as a simple tweaking of the law on the one hand, you know, a tidying up of needlessly discriminatory legislation on the one hand, versus those on the other side who are opposing same-sex marriage but are desperate for religious exemptions, who simply want a loophole to be created in the form of this ongoing practice of the creation of religious exemptions, which, to be frank, I have huge problems with the very notion, to be frank, of religious exemptions.
Oh, I think you're simplifying it here, Scott.
Really?
Sorry, I don't mean to get in the way. Well, I actually think that unspoken symbolism you've identified is at the heart of this strategy. So the seeking of loopholes and the dragging out of the debate as a way of, you know, delaying tactics through plebiscites and all that kind of stuff, all the game playing that has gone on here and the way the other issues are being dragged into this that I'm still yet to be convinced are relevant in any kind of empirical way. All of that, I think, is precisely because what is at issue is the symbolic equality that you're talking about, the symbolic capital R recognition. It's just that the no case particularly doesn't want to accept that or doesn't want to admit that.
Oh, look,
because then it becomes a very, very difficult argument to have.
I think
the yes case has got an issue here as well, because they're engaging in the love is love, you know, it's about marriage, it's about people marrying each other, when I think the fundamental debate underneath that is about capital R recognition,
yes.
But we're not quite having that conversation. And on the flip side, the religious freedom argument, I think it's not really about religious freedom. It's about a social conversation about what we think marriage is.
Isn't that interesting?
Which we keep positioning as a sacred cow. You know, that what's that slogan they say? It's a marriage, politics and money, or, you know, what are the fundamental values of our society? Marriage is actually there as one of them. And that's where you get to bring in, you know, what happens to the children, all that sort of stuff. So it is a religious argument, but in a sense it's not a... It's not a faith-based argument, you know, about a specific religion. It's about what's the place of marriage in our society.
But aren't we better served then to allow both of these debates to be what they fully are? In other words, to be a debate about capital R recognition on the one hand, recognition in the fullest social sense, and capital R notion of religious freedom as a fundamental human right rather than as something that's been carved out by means of a series of exceptions.
I think you're overlooking something really... I think that debate would become a debate about whether or not I accept your existence. That's what it will boil down to. Am I wrong?
I have no doubt that for some actors in this debate, yes, possibly.
I don't see how it avoids that. Like, once you say this is a debate about recognition, about the conferral of full dignity... then you are going to find, and I think this would be unique to the no side because it's the side that's denying the request, if you like, or the demand, then the only way to resist that would be to say, well, yes, I don't want to confer that.
But see, I think that there would be many, many people... Wow, I'm really worried about this conversation becoming something other than what we maybe intended it to. there would be many, many people who would balk, and I think rightly, at going to that extent, that would go to that degree.
But they might balk at it, but maybe that's the problem with the debate, is that the real debate we need to be having is that holding space that allows what, let's call it a third of the Australian population, that quite doesn't know, unquote. They need space to ask that question. Because I think, it, again, you could put this as competing rights slash responsibilities, recognition of LGBTI people as full members of the community with human dignity, and the issue of marriage. And we keep conflating those two things. And I think a lot of people just want a little bit of space to ask those questions and think them through without being held down as either being a religious bigot or a homophobe.
So this is a form. This is a form of gradualism. In other words, this is one of the ways in which we carve out legislative space within a society that has a very, very difficult time overcoming incommensurable agreements. It's one of the ways that we create spaces for moderate civic disagreement rather than allowing things to come to the boil.
So what's the this in this sentence? Do you mean the political process we're undergoing with the plebiscite? Do you mean the whole issue? Do you mean the debate we're kind of having but not having around the issue?
I mean the minimization of this from not being a capital R, a form of capital R recognition, to being something that really is a mere extension
of marriage rights. I think what you said is right. And I think, to some extent, and maybe this will put it on more comfortable ground where you can have a crack at liberalism, Scott, but to some extent, that's how we negotiate things within a liberal society, isn't it? Because we can't have a contest on ontologies. We can't have a contest on any kind of serious cosmic construction of values or virtues or anything like that, because that very quickly becomes illiberal. So the only question, the only way you can really resolve these questions within a liberal context is via a question of rights, and particularly individual rights. And those rights then have to be shorn of, I don't know, the cultural and moral weight that they might carry, because that then takes you again into illiberal territory. So we're kind of... We're destined to have a conversation that becomes a more sterile question of rights, if you like, because that's the only liberal language that there is to resolve these sorts of things, isn't there? Mm. Or is there something wrong in my liberalism?
Well, I'm happy to have a crack at that, but I'm eager for Peter to weigh in first.
That's a really interesting way of putting it, because it also positions religious freedom as being about one voice. So the idea that there is one religious view. And maybe one of the problems in this debate is we're still not getting the multiplicity of views out there. So at the moment, maybe there's a bit of, you know, I'm a Christian and I support marriage equality going on as a bit of a protest vote. But I think there's actually a much deeper diversity under that in the Australian population. And, you know, my liberal fantasy is that parliamentary democracy would work, and instead of slanging off at each other in question time, every member of parliament would make their statement about what they think about this issue in the parliament itself, on the record, and have an informed debate that was open to other views. But that feels like a bit of a dream at the moment, in order to have that diversity of voices rather than this simple yes-no.
But it's not that there's not a diversity of voices, particularly on the question of religious freedom or religious practice. It's just that the religious freedom question doesn't come up if you don't have a religious problem. And you're right, there are a lot of religious people who don't have a problem and they don't see an issue. You know, there'll be ministers of various churches who are gay, who will get married under these things. That will happen depending on which denomination you want to focus on. It's just that they're not kind of relevant to the religious freedom conversation in quite the same way.
I disagree. I think they're completely relevant because those people are the ones whose religious freedom is being most trespassed upon. So think of yourself...
What, by the denial, you mean?
That's right. So think of yourself as a, you know, let's call you a straight, happily married, just once minister in a Christian denomination, and you fundamentally believe the teaching of the Bible is that you should be marrying same-sex couples, and your church says you can't.
Right.
So you're in exactly the same position as someone who's got to make a choice about the exercise of their
conscience. Sure, but that's not a religious freedom question that anyone but the church can resolve, right? That's a religious freedom question. The state can't go along to a church and say, henceforth, your doctrine will be X. Section 116 of the Constitution, if nothing else, makes that something that's impossible.
Sure.
So it's not the same question, is it?
It isn't, but it also helps us, I think, take the baker of the wedding cake for the gay couple off the table as well. It's a similar kind of phenomenon.
Right.
You know, you could go and run a different business. You could do it in a different way. That's okay. So, I think that does get us back to if we go back to my notion of religious freedom, what's the right you're protecting for someone? What's the harm that's going to come to that person if you don't have this freedom here? There's probably less of that on the table for this particular debate.
Let's just flesh this out a little bit further, though, because look, I often hear the kind of the gay wedding cake example, or even just to pick up one of the other examples from before, of say a church gay aged care facility denying housing to a same-sex couple. I mean, I actually find both of those examples on every level, morally, theologically speaking, absolutely abhorrent, because the issue there isn't right of service. The issue there isn't even one of religious freedom or even discrimination. The issue there is a much more fundamental Christian theological moral principle, which is the basic hospitality that one is obliged to show someone who classifies as one's neighbor, which within the Christian theological tradition ends up being far more people than you would have expected. That kind of basic affront, the basic refusal to offer hospitality to others is something, I mean, far worse than being discriminatory. I mean, it's damn sinful. So I think that there's an awful lot here that I think could productively, rightly be addressed at the level of internal theological discourse that needn't be muddied with the whole issue of religious freedom. At the same time, though, I guess, Peter, I still find myself really uncomfortable with your reductive notion of religious freedom as the ability to observe external forms of worship without fear of persecution. Because as soon as you then kind of take that Lockean tradition across the Atlantic and you find it in the United States in the hands of someone like Roger Williams, then the importance of the importance of one's conscience in not being forced to do things that, not as a matter of choice or as a matter of free will, if you like, but as a matter of conviction that I have been owned by a tradition that I did not choose and whose terms I don't control. And that tradition tells me that two members of the same sex can't be rightly married before God. I mean, that is a much more serious issue of conscience, I think. And it does butt up against the question of religious practice and therefore the terms of religious freedom. That becomes something completely different, don't you think?
Yes, I do, but I want to stick with your aged care example first, because I think, again, there's a competing notion of hospitality there. How far do we extend hospitality? And that's when I talk about responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I think the Catholic Church, to name the name, is getting caned a lot in the press at the moment, because I suspect most Australians actually respect the fundamental values that it stands for, the dignity of each human being, the principle of love, the principle of service of others. But every time it makes a statement that appears to contradict what those values mean in the eyes of a secular nation, they get caned, and, you know, with some reason. So in the aged care example, the difficulty is, does the religious service provider of that aged care not only provide good aged care to an individual, but also in a way that respects the moral choices that individual has made? And again, I just feel like we're there in an area of what I want to call responsibilities, not freedom.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I feel like there are some cases where these questions have been emphatically resolved. So the medical profession is a good example, right? If you are a doctor and someone is coming to you for treatment, you do not ask questions about, is this person a neo-Nazi sympathizer or whatever it might be. There is nothing other than the human being that is in front of you. And maybe it's because the idea of medical treatment is so sacred and so important that we just can't, it's intolerable to think of the idea of that being denied, that there could be any arbitration in the provision of that service. And maybe it's because of the lightness of providing a cake that these questions come up. I don't know.
And why aren't people talking about the provision of champagne? I mean, I haven't heard of a bottle shop that's not selling champagne to gay couples.
To be honest, I haven't heard of that many cake makers in this situation anyway. I don't know where the cake thing came from except via a campaign in the United States. But anyway.
Well, there was actually a legal case in the US. But
Was there one case?
There was indeed. There was indeed.
It's funny how you can go searching for these things. God, there's so much more I would love to unpack here, including what happens when the discrimination goes the other way and whether or not that should be protected as well. Anyway, but we're out of time,
but
Scott.
But I do think, I do think, just as sort of as a final note, I think reasonable civil accommodation to one another whenever humanly possible, that idea, I think, has actually stood the test of time when it comes to negotiate one another's consciences.
No, I think that's true.
I couldn't agree more.
Peter, thank you.
My pleasure.